There's a better world is coming, tell you why. There's a better world is coming, tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea and in the sky. There's a better world is coming, tell you why. There's a better world is coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world is coming, don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome once again to Progressive News Network. I'm your host, News Director Rick Spezak, with my associate producer, Ms. Renee Shaker. Renee, welcome.
Hey, Rick.
Cool. Listen, we've got an anti-war show for you today, a peace activist show. We're going to have the opinions, thoughts, and reactions of Sandy Davies from PDA, Jay Jensen, longtime anti-war crimes activist, Gwen Holden Berry, longtime journalist, progressive, and anti-war person, Hillary Keyes with Code Pink, Emily Dillick, publisher, journalist, women's rights activist, Suki DeYoung, longtime peace activist, Nia Stewart, activist, environmentalist, Alan Maki, longtime peace activist, and we're going to have a wonderful discussion from each of these fine people, and we're also going to have a roundtable as well. So before we do that, ladies and gentlemen, this is what tonight's show is all about. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, war. What is it good for? Well, we're going to hear the thoughts and experiences of a fine selection of anti-war and pro-peace activists. They're going to be able to give you their thoughts, talk to you about what we're in right now, and the road ahead, give us their insights into the tactics that they're going to suggest. So before we do that, of course, we're always going to do the news. Some important news stories you need to hear about. It will be a surprise to probably very few that another GOP congressperson stepped in a really interesting bit of Back to the Future. And when Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee suggested on Meet the Press that women don't want equal pay laws, Blackburn, although female, is no friend to women. She voted against the 2009 Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. Who'd be in favor of fair pay? A landmark bill for women's rights in the workplace, a measure making it easier for women to file wage discrimination suits against their employers. Blackburn, not to be accused of flip-flopping, also voted against the Paycheck Fairness Act of 2009. Of course, again, who would be in favor of fair pay for women? My goodness, obviously not Congresswoman Blackburn. I think that it's more important than is making certain that women are recognized by these companies. You know, I've always said that I didn't want to be given a job because I was a female. I wanted it because I was the most qualified person for the job. And making certain that companies are going to move forward in that vein, that's what women want. They don't want the decisions made in Washington. They want to be able to have the power and the control and the ability to make those decisions for themselves. Okay, that's the thoughts of the day from Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn, who's leading her people, those she serves, into the future. This news from the Fukushima front, and not to be outdone, Fukushima's making new headlines every day. It just seems that yesterday, a portion of dust beside the road, in other words, the road in front of a temple of Onada area, Nami town of Fukushima Prefecture, has measured 7.97 microsieverts per hour in the air at chest high and measured 86.09 microsieverts per hour 1 centimeter from the roadside dust. This is basically off the scale radiation, very, very dangerous to human beings. And of course, we have nuclear fever here in the U.S. too. Professors announced that there's a possible explosion near the St. Louis area nuclear site. Steam is increasing from an underground fire and may be moving closer to radioactive waste stored in St. Louis. Assistant Attorney General Joe Binbutel said the new evidence, including increasing amounts of steam in the neck area between the two sites, showed some potential movement in that, that direction. Ed Smith of the Missouri Coalition for Environmental Issues also cited temperature monitoring that shows rising levels of heat close to the nuclear waste. Heat from any fire at the nuclear site could spark an explosion in the methane pockets or buried gas cylinders, throwing radioactive particles in the air, said Bob Crist, professor of earth and planetary science at Washington University in St. Louis, who studied environmental concerns at the landfill. The fire could also create subsurface voids that might expose nuclear waste to wind and rain, especially problematic since the landfill sits in the Missouri River floodplain. The bottom line, it's very serious. What happened up here is not something that has ever been encountered before. They've had landfill fires and nuclear waste, but never in such close proximity, said nearby resident Don Chapman. So there we have it, some interesting nuclear news. And now a little more news for you. NATO and Syria. And NATO Attorney General Anders Fogh Rasmussen begins a two-day visit to Washington on Thursday, a time when the alliance members are grappling over how to deal with the situation in Syria and the shape of the mission in Afghanistan after the non-withdrawal of combat troops next year. While the alliance remains engaged in Afghanistan, there's no hope of marriage yet. Where the combat mission is winding down, it's also been facing new security challenges in the edges of Europe, most notably in Syria, where the U.S. and its allies in Europe are pondering whether to bolster support of the anti-regime rebels in the two-year civil war. And in terms of hearts and minds, we know the rebels clearly have their eye on the hearts and minds. During this visit, Fogh Rasmussen is scheduled to meet with President Barack Obama, as well as with Secretary of State John Kerry, National Security Advisor Tom Donilon, according to the NATO news release. Peabody drills miners for pension profits. UMWA speaks out against a bankruptcy ruling that cuts off retiree health care. U.S. Bankruptcy Court of the Eastern District of Missouri has ruled in favor of proposals by the Patriot Coal to eliminate its collective bargaining agreements. That's what you call a one-sided cancellation. The USA Bankruptcy Court has ruled in favor. The United Mine Workers of America has adamantly denounced the ruling and plans to appeal in federal district court. Patriot was created by Peabody Energy in 2007 with 43% of Peabody's liabilities, but only 11% of its assets. Because Patriot was created with insufficient assets to meet its liabilities to retired miners, analysts such as Bruce Rader, professor of finance at Temple University, has described the company as designed to fail. By creating Patriot and allowing it to go bankrupt, Peabody's deprived tens of thousands of workers of the benefits they had earned. Under bankruptcy court rulings, Patriot will be allowed to cease paying retiree health care as early as July 1. Responsibilities for paying benefits will be handed over to the Voluntary Employee Benefit Association, VEBA, which will only have guaranteed funding for $15 million plus a royalty payment of 2 cents a ton of coal that the company produced, which may add approximately $5 million to the VEBA per year. Current health care costs for these retirees average nearly $7 million per month. There we have it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to hand the mic over to my good friend and colleague, associate producer, Ms. Renee Shaker. Renee, you've got some news for us, too.
Thank you, Rick. There's a very interesting article I found in The Nation magazine on May 13th, and it's entitled The Chechen Connection. And since we're talking about war, this is an area that is obviously very inundated with the sad tragedy. And I thought I would pick this piece up. This is written by a professor in Montana who teaches Middle Eastern studies, and called The Chechen Connection. When a local newspaper here in Montana called for my views on a 19-year-old wrestler named Zokhar Tsarnaev, with a confusing pedigree of being a Chechen from Dagestan who was reportedly born in Kyrgyzstan but mostly grew up in the United States, and what his motivations were for the Boston Marathon terror attacks, I tried to use my background as a resident Chechenologist to help out. Answering the second part of the question, why, was easy. I did not know Tsarnaev's motivations, but if he is guilty of the bombings, and I have little doubt at this point that he is, there must be a link to the deeply troubled history of Chechnya and to the generation of anger, despair, and trauma experienced by these people. To start, Chechens are not Russians, but a distinct national and lingual group known as the Neks or Vanaks, who are indigenous to the north slope of the Caucasus mountain range, where they have lived since before recorded history. Rather like Native American peoples, whose sad history is a strange and cruel mirror of the Chechens' experience at the hands of the Russian imperialism, the people of Chechnya do not call themselves Chechens. In their own language, as distinct from Russian as Navajo is from English, they are Naxi, which translates more or less as the people. During the Murid Wars of the 19th century, the Chechens were the backbone of Muslim tribal resistance to Tsarist expansion, earning the reputation as fearless Sufi-inspired warriors. After the resistance collapsed with the capture of Imam Shamil, an event somewhat akin to the surrender of Sioux Lakota chief Sitting Bull, many of those warriors took their skills into exile, serving the Ottoman Empire in problematic border areas such as the Balkans and the Arab lands of the Levant, where they became known under the generic name Circassians, a term that includes related northern Caucasus mountaineers who were also driven into exile by the Tsars. By the 1920s and 30s, the Chechens maintained a low-boil resistance to Soviet rule and collectivization. But it was also thanks to Joseph Stalin and his commissars that Chechnya was first defined as an autonomous republic, a territorial entity replete with borders, an official culture, and other Soviet-style attributes of statehood. Many other marginal peoples in the USSR did not fare so well and were thus absorbed into larger non-Slavic nutshells whenever Stalin sneezed. This sneeze for the Chechens came in February 1944, when Stalin accused the Chechens of collaborating with the Nazis, dissolved their autonomous republic, and sent the new non-people into exile in Siberia and Soviet Central Asia. They were transported in boxcars, chillingly similar to those that brought Jews to Hitler's death camps. In the case of the Chechens, roughly half of the exactly 478,000 who were exiled died en route. The vizil, or deportation, became the defining event in Chechen collective memory, as resonant as the Trail of Tears for the Cherokees or the Holocaust for European Jews. In the gulags and collective farms of Central Asian exile, mostly Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, the Chechens honed a reputation for toughness. Some remain in Kyrgyzstan to this day, having chosen not to return to their homeland after their rehabilitation by Nikita Khrushchev in 1957. Those who did return to Chechnya did so with a collective bad attitude, as well as a reputation for ruthlessness and organized crime. Paradoxically, the Chechens also excelled in the Soviet security services. Reminiscent of American Indians in the U.S. Armed Forces, a disproportionately high percentage of Chechens rose to officer and even general rank in the Red Army, the police, and the KGB. Zokhar Dudayev achieved the rank of Major General in the Soviet Air Force, commanding a squadron of nuclear bombers in anticipation of World War III. It was General Dudayev who led Chechnya's break with Russia in 1991 when the USSR collapsed. He didn't so much declare independence as announce that Chechnya had never been part of Russia. This attitude, and the fact that Grozny, Chechnya's capital, had become synonymous with organized crime, tempted Russian President Boris Yeltsin to, quote, restore constitutional order, unquote, over the wayward self-described Chechen Republic of Ichkeria in 1994, a military adventure that was also intended to serve as a distraction from serious problems in Moscow. But what was supposed to have been a small victorious war did not go well for Russians. After the loss of some 90,000 lives, most of them Chechens, and the destruction of virtually all of Chechnya's infrastructure, Moscow had to sign a humiliating ceasefire in 1996. The carnage was truly mind-boggling and begs comparisons now to battlegrounds like Syria. General Dudayev did not survive the first war. In murky circumstances, he was blasted into collective memory by what is believed to have been a laser-guided missile homing in on his satellite telephone as he waited to speak with an American interlocutor working on a peace deal. True or not, to this day, many Chechens are firmly convinced of a U.S. connection to the assassination. Even more galling was President Bill Clinton's description at the time of the brutal Russo-Chechen War as somehow akin to the American Civil War. Then came the nearly suicidal capture of Grozny by the Chechen resistance in August 1996, which forced Yeltsin to the negotiating table. Despite its David versus Goliath victory over the Russian bear, things did not go well for independent Chechnya. With Dudayev's death, the tiny quasi-country slowly descended into lawlessness as well as Islamic revival, thanks to the presence of al-Qaeda-connected fighters from the Arab world, many of whom fought in Afghanistan, as well as even darker forces that many attribute to the KGB. One result was the opening of an immense fissure in post-war Chechen society. On one side were the nationalists who practiced a traditional form of Sufi Islam. On the other were growing numbers of Chechens whose devotion to the concept of an al-Qaeda-style Muslim caliph superseded their loyalty to the Chechen nation-state itself. In 1999, when these Salafists began exporting their fundamentalist ideology to the neighboring Autonomous Republic of Dagestan and then allegedly blew up a series of apartment buildings in Russian cities, Yeltsin's prime minister and then replacement president Vladimir Putin launched the so-called Second Russo-Chechen War, which arguably continues to this day. Putin was assisted in this task by major Chechen defectors, which further divided Chechen society into at least three groups: the Dudayevist nationalists, who continued their guerrilla war from forest hideouts, a pro-Russian and pro-Russian collaborators known as Kadyrovists, currently in control of the Russian-backed government in Grozny, and thirdly, the al-Qaeda-associated Salafists, whose war has expanded from the Caucasus region to Afghanistan, Iraq, and now Syria. At the very least, it seems that Dzhokhar's oldest brother, Tamerlan, and perhaps Dzhokhar too, identified with extremist Islamists, as opposed to the strangely and sadly divided Chechen nationalists associated with Dudayev, the ill-fated president of the equally ill-fated post-Soviet republic. I guess it will all come out as Dudayev is interrogated and tried. Now, my suspicion lies with the brothers having abandoned their compatriots' weird and horrible 200-year-old resistance against Russia to embrace the Salafist line of global jihad across the United States. Myself, I am filled with an immense sadness for all involved, the dead and maimed runners of the Boston Marathon, as well as the soul-scarred citizens of the blighted states of Chechnya. Sad story. Rick?
Thank you very much. And I'm about to bring on our first guest, and I want to just give him this musical cue. Sandy Davies, welcome.
Yes, hello, Rick. Hey, thanks for having me on.
Hey, so, listen, it's our pleasure. We're going to talk peace, and Sandy, I couldn't think of anybody I'd rather have on first. Sandy,
okay.
What do you think, buddy?
Well, you know, I thought since I'm the first one on, the best thing I can do is just to start with a little peace activism 101 and kind of leave it to the others to come up with more creative ideas. First of all, presumably anybody listening to this, you know, is doing so because you believe in peace. And as we discovered in 1967 when John Lennon and the Beatles recorded that song, so do an awful lot of other people. Most Americans do not want their country to be at war with anyone. Most Americans do not support having a military budget that is higher than at any time during the Cold War. These are very simple propositions that most people agree with. So the question becomes, how do we actually get our politicians to comply with the wishes of most Americans to not support wars and to not support absurd levels of military spending? Now, just about anybody who has ever worked in a congressional office will tell you that their members and their staff get their view of how their constituents feel mainly from the calls and emails that they receive from their constituents. And so the most basic, simple thing that anyone who cares about these issues can do is to call and email your member of Congress on these issues. Now, and there are a lot of organizations in this country that send out action alerts that will keep you appraised of hot issues. For instance, this month in June, as it does every year, the U.S. Congress will be debating the record military budget, which is down very slightly from its actual record maybe 3 or 4 years ago. But it has not significantly gone down. It is still higher than at any time during the Cold War. And so what I would urge all of you to do is to get on the email list of the following. I'm just going to give you six groups. You should be on if you care about these issues, you should be on the email lists of these groups. And when they send you an email and ask you to call your member of Congress or to click on a button to send an email, you should do it. That is the bare minimum that anyone who cares about these issues should be doing. So the organizations that I can think of, these are certainly not the only ones, are United for Peace and Justice, that's UFPJ. You can Google each of these to find their web addresses. Peace Action, Code Pink, Roots Action, Just Foreign Policy, and U.S. Labor Against War. I can also mention PDA, which I work with, and if you go to the PDA website, that's Progressive Democrats of America, and click on issues, you can go to our End War and Occupation page, and you know, you're very welcome to do that too. So these are just the basic things that we can all do. PDA in Miami, we had Medea Benjamin down here in January. She spoke at an event for the 11th anniversary of the opening of the American concentration camp in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And she also, since she's a PDA board member, came and spoke at a PDA meeting. And she told us that between 2008 and 2009, more than half of the people on Code Pink's email list unsubscribed. Now, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I'm not going to try and explain why they did that. It had something to do with electing one corrupt politician rather than another one to be president. But as I say, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I'm not going to go any further with that. But if you care about these issues, the only way that the people making decisions on these issues and voting in Congress on these issues are going to know that you even care about them is if they hear from you. So this is just the most basic thing that you can do, is to connect with these groups. Many of them, if you go to their websites, you can get more involved than that. But at the very least, get on their email lists and simply do what they ask you to do. If, you know, there will be amendments to this military budget bill that they can either vote for or against. That will include probably votes to cut specific weapon systems from the budget. It will include, hopefully, the last couple of years it has, an amendment from Barbara Lee to actually withdraw all our troops immediately from Afghanistan. And there will be several others. But to be plugged in and able to do something about this, you know, you need to be on the email list of these groups. So that's basically what I wanted to say. As I say,
that's
peace activism,
Sandy.
101. That should be a start for everybody.
Oh, that's an excellent way to begin. I couldn't thank you enough, Sandy. And before I bring our next one on, a little sound cue tonight.
Well, come on, all of you big, strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again.
Uncle Sam needs your help again. Uncle Sam needs your help again. Uncle Sam needs your help again.
And there we have it. Once, twice, three times, Uncle Sam needs your help again. And so many of our recent veterans have gone back three, four, five times and more. I'd like to bring on our next guest. Jay, are you there?
Jay.
Yes, Jay Jansen, are you there, sir?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, that's great, Jay.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Oh, you're very welcome. Glad you could come. Why don't you give us some thoughts about yourself or where you see the peace movement today, sir?
Okay. My name is Jay Jansen. That's J-A-N-S-O-N. It's misspelled on the site. If you Google Jay Jansen, you'll get like 50 pages of my articles. The first entry that comes up is my op-ed news author page with 300 illustrated titles. A few years ago, Howard Zinn encouraged me to use his name in founding, along with Ramsey Clark, the Martin Luther King Condemned U.S. Wars International Awareness Campaign. And I'd say probably all the people on the panel that are representing organizations are probably endorsing this, because all the sincere anti-war and peace organizations and most of the top journalists, Bishop Tutu, all endorse it. And they, for sure, it's called the King Condemned U.S. Wars. I'm also the website historian for Prosecute U.S. Crimes Against Humanity Now campaign. Supported by Dissident Voice, an entirely educational site containing the pertinent laws, exhortations from Einstein, King, Chomsky, and others, and featuring a country-by-country history of U.S. crimes in 19 countries. You know, Martin Luther King said, "We must speak out for those who are denied a voice." This comes easy to me as I've lived my 82-year life mostly outside the United States, mostly in countries bombed by my fellow Americans. I have both Korean and Vietnamese family. I have more friends, obviously, abroad than I have in the States, from China to Syria and 68 countries my work as a musician has taken me to. Apart from my work as a musician, my life is dedicated to stop Americans from continuing to mass murder for maintenance of equally genocidal overseas predatory investments, of which I, myself, and all Americans must be guilty of in one way or another. The theme for this round table is exploring future tactics for peace activists. But the word peace or anti-war have long been co-opted into meaninglessness. The fake Carnegie Peace Foundation, the fraudulent wealthy United Nations NGO peace organizations, all big organized religions have funded peace organizations while their priests and ministers bless atrocity wars as just. I suggest a round table discuss dropping the now suspect meaningless title peace. Name an action, an achievable goal. Honestly intend to get something done. Name it by that rather than, you know, everyone in their right mind is in favor of peace, justice, and war. A peace, justice, and war protest has not saved one single life, nor stopped or prevented any war. We have to be more honest with ourselves, Richard. Who intends to stop Americans from killing? Who is going to bell the cat? Who among us believes Americans can be stopped from killing? Has anyone in spite of the history proven otherwise? Obviously believe that Americans will be stopped from killing by protest? It's just a thing to do. We do it because it makes ourselves feel better. You know, feel less guilty, look like American good guys. Protest leaders point their fingers at the government and away from themselves. But Martin Luther King held himself and America and ordinary Americans responsible for being entirely capable of making atrocity wars unacceptable and inoperable through non-participation, non-support, non-acquiescence, and conscientious objection. Our very own elected and re-elected government, King dismissed his government as the greatest purveyor, not cause of violence in the world. He did not address a single word in his Beyond Vietnam sermon to the government, not a single word he spoke to us. The second way the U.S. peace movement goes flat against Martin Luther King is by mixing in and sapping the time and energy away from the war issue with issues of social well-being for Americans on every issue under the sun. Imagine focusing on social justice for Americans while these very same Americans continue to massacre the poor overseas. King had said it was not logical for no progress on social issues at home could be made while the massive expenditure of human and my financial resources are devoted to a war. Never mind King. The wars are merely on the same level as sundry and selfish domestic concerns. Housing, sexual rights, jobs, higher wages, health care for killer Americans. Makes no sense. I want to sum up with our beloved U.S. Congresswoman, Cynthia McKinney, while in Tripoli, is a guest of the Libyans during the U.S.-NATO bombing. She could have called for the prosecution of U.S. crimes against humanity in Libya and gotten some good attention as a congresswoman. Instead, she comes back and says, we have to write to Congress. We have to call Congress. As if Congress, and not the business world that owns Congress, was in charge. Anti-organization leaders, some of the people on the panel maybe, visit Pakistan and Afghanistan victims while the victims are under bombing attacks still. As if the people visiting them were good and innocent Americans, and they say their purpose was to draw attention to the fact that people are being killed by the bombings. As if Americans didn't know that. If you drop a bomb, somebody's going to be killed, right? The Veterans for Peace don't proclaim conscientious objection, as King implored us to. The Peace Activists and Journal, this is my summation, and I would like to direct it to the first person who spoke, Mr. Danny. The Peace Activists and Journalists are playing an important rear guard protective action for imperialist wars by misleading the public to see these crimes against humanity as merely foreign policy mistakes that can be corrected by calling your congressman moral indignation. As you see, Richard, the business world is amoral in nature. It has to be. Good guys don't win ball games. Business is just business. When wars become less profitable or endanger investments, they are ended. Only the threat of possible imprisonment could possibly be factored in the accounting and end the wars earlier. I thank you very much for listening to me, everybody, and I hope I fit into this discussion. As you know, I think I'm maybe the only person that doesn't have I don't really relate to Americans. You know, I have all my loved ones and friends are all non-Americans, and except for being a musician in the country, and I have a lot of black friends and musicians, but otherwise, I'm kind of like out of my element, really. But thank you very much for listening to me, everybody. I'll be listening to you, and when I'm called upon again, maybe I can add something further.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Jay. I appreciate that. We're expecting our good friend Hillary, excuse me, Gwen Holden Berry in next. And let's see if we can bring her in. Gwen, are you in the queue? I don't see you up on the board yet.
I'm there.
Oh.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you 5x5, my dear. Welcome, Ms. Gwen Holden Berry, who is senior producer of Here Be Monsters.
Here.
A wonderful show. And, Gwen, tell us about your thoughts on peace. You've been an activist for a long, long time.
I am. And I'm also one of those new agey kind of people, too. So I basically have... I have many facets, but solutions instead of anger and fueling the crisis, more crisis is what I would suggest. That's the real activism, is finding solutions. And I would say a spiritually aligned activism, which understands that there's a turning of cosmic seasons that we're experiencing right now. And that brings the focus to our loss of humanity and human rights that's going on across the globe. We're on the wrong side of history. We are searching for our humanity again. The global leadership is on the wrong side of it. there's new solar and cosmic influences that are urging change, not only here, but through all the planets of our solar system, and that's the science. This tells us that... while there's a greater change than we realize going on out there, there's also a greater support for us to finally stand in our integrity and find the solutions that for the Judeo-Christian, Islamic, and really for the last 12,000 years, and most religious-based societies have found only one solution to, and that's been war. New solutions are right in front of us. All we have to do is grasp them. And one of the ways we do it is by working together. The trends now of good health for humanity and the environment are shifting us into a more local sustainability and a slow regrowth of true community. That's where many of our peaceful solutions are waiting for us, in the rebirth of community and caring for one another locally so that it can spread out through this planetary consciousness we're taking advantage of right now, the technology of the internet and the social networks, where a real global village is beginning to take shape. There's no real solution to the corrupt leadership that stands over us except the education of the public through the dissemination of facts, because truth is a perspective. And that's what you do, Rick. That's what I do. It's what most of the folks you have on this roundtable do. The facts remain the facts, and they're absent by way of corporate manipulation right now, enabling people to hear and discuss and put out their own voices. That's a great step towards solutions becoming. The leadership machine needs to break. It really does, on a global basis. We're at a real place where change can come, and at a pace that isn't called, you know, apocalypse. It can come through activism peacefully. I have friends across the planet, Rick. I see them face-to-face through technology. We hang out in Google Hangouts. We found each other. Most of us agree our leadership is corrupt, and we shouldn't be. We should be taking the peaceful path. And that's basically my gig. That's what I got to say.
Well, thank you so much, Gwen. You know that you have so much respect for me. You're not only a person that works in journalism, you're a planetary worker in the best sense of the word, and you're a healer in your profession. I just think that the work that you do as a journalist and as a healer is just remarkable. And
you're
a real treasure to our community, and I thank you for the work that you do every day. And, you know, this is a great time to mention, so I do have another second, that Gwen is part of a group of great activist progressive journalists whose names and shows I want to rattle off because I always want to mention them in every show. Gwen Holdenberry and her Therapy Monsters show, fantastic presentation every Sunday. It's the hour before ours from 6 to 7. Make sure you tune in. Gwen always has guests we need to hear from. Then we've got Anita Stewart's going to be on tonight. She does a show called Wise Women, a fantastic show. Always, again, good people. Brian Stetton, his show, Progress Toward Democracy, is on, I think, Monday nights and Friday nights. Susan Nylon with the Nylon Report out of Sarasota. It's on weekdays, I think, around the drive time hour. Sita Ben-Yi, she has a wonderful show on Sita Media out of the Melbourne area. Emily Dillick we'll be hearing from also tonight. Her new presentation is a publication called Progressive News, and you should tune into that too. A wonderful activist and women's rights activist. Gwen, did you hear that story about that congresswoman from Tennessee? My God, voted against pay equity. You know, what is she
thinking? You got to wonder. You know, my mom was a Republican right down here in South Florida, but she was not the kind of Republican they breed today. She took me to have lunch when I was in my teens at a meeting of, I think it was, they called it Normal, but it was the guest speaker, and the guest I got to meet was Gloria Steinem.
No,
now, that was a Republican mom, you know?
Yeah, back when Republicans actually had, ideas, and we're looking to a future that encompassed all of us. That's great. So women were actually people at that meeting then, huh?
Yeah, and there were all kinds of people there, including a few gals in bell bottoms and tie dye, and it was kind of cool. Boy, am I giving age out here.
Oh well, listen, we've all been on a few spins on the planet. Thanks so much, Gwen. We'll be on the round table. Oh, you're very welcome, my dear. The roundtable will start about 8:30. I'd like to also bring on another one of my friends, longtime activist, Miss Hillary Keys of Code Pink. Hillary, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick. Thanks for doing this. This is really, really fascinating and exciting. I've actually never done this before, so I'm going to try my best. But
you'll do fine.
And I apologize, I did not get to hear the last speaker because my computer decided to stop for a minute. But as you put on the thing, I'm an activist with Code Pink, an organizer. I'm also an organizer with Democracy for America and Awake Palm Beach County, among other things, and basically just an obsessed activist. As Sandy Davies mentioned, Code Pink is, an organization that if you go to the Code Pink website, codepink.org, you can find out a lot of what nationally is going on and get on the mailing list for updates. What I would really like to talk to briefly today is that I believe that in addition to the reactive protesting things that we're doing, we also need to be, and note that I'm saying also, not saying instead of, put some attention and effort on proactive programs to change from a culture of violence to a culture of peace building. The two things that I think are really important is, one, we've got to find a way to get laws that will eliminate or at least seriously cut down on the profit motive for war. Because until we can get the profit motive out of war, it's going to be hard to do much of anything else. And the other thing is that in February, Representative Barbara Lee reintroduced a bill that was originally Dennis Kucinich bill called it for the Department of Peace, and it's been renamed the Department of Peace Building, which I think is really powerful, because a lot of people that I spoke to when I was advocating for the Department of Peace legislation were saying, oh, you know, that this sounded very, you know, very 60s, I mean, which I just had to laugh at that. But the Department of Peace Building, according to the website, a Department of Peace would institute offices of peace building, education and training, domestic peace activities, international peace activities, arms control and disarmament, work proactively and interactively with each branch of government on policy matters relating to conditions of peace, would offer experience and expertise to the United States and seek participation in the development of policy from private, public, and non-governmental organizations, research effective violence reduction programs and promote and promulgate such programs within government and society, develop new policies and programs and expand on existing effective policies and programs to address personal and family violence, to reduce prison recidivism, to develop and expand peace education curriculum in schools, to promote nonviolent conflict resolution strategies and civilian peacekeepers where appropriate. I mean, I think that really starting to get to the root of how do we teach peace building, how do we have the best minds researching, how do we create cultures of nonviolence, and how do we implement that in our schools, in our government, in our communities, and in the matters of international and national policy. So the bill is H.R. 808. It's the same number that it's been for a while. And I am just thinking that with between the situations of war throughout the world, our war tendency in our society, the gun violence, the bombing violence, both in our country and that we perpetrate abroad, I think that we really need to try and, in addition to doing the protests, to start working on how do we create a society that is based on peace building. And I think that's all I have to say.
Well, that's great. That's great, Hill. Thanks. Thanks a lot.
And that's, you know, Rick, that brings up a good point. We can look at what our educators have been doing in our schools. Simple things like trying to reduce bullying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a culture of violence that starts very, very young. And educators have recognized that, you know, the issue of bullying is something that can't be dismissed as just childhood antics anymore, but needs to be addressed from a policy standpoint. And bringing these children up with skills on conflict resolution and alternatives to dealing with their anger other than violence and verbal and physical violence. So, you know, Hillary's points are very, very important, especially, you know, when you look at how we're not going to be able to stop the profit motive today, but we can start working on other issues that could lead us in the right direction.
Absolutely. Good point.
Yeah.
Good point.
And with what you're saying about that we're not going to be able to stop it today, I know that on several of the things that I've been involved with, I've had people respond, oh, that's never going to happen. And I say, you know what? There was a time when people said that about women getting the vote. Okay? It didn't happen
Absolutely.
Right away, but if nobody starts working on it, then you're right, it won't happen. But if we start working on it, then it might actually happen.
Exactly. I mean, we could look at, in more recent history, you know, the campaign to stop smoking, even campaigns to get people to use seatbelts while driving. So there are ways that through public policy we can begin to get people to look at issues in a different way.
Yeah, there's another aspect to this, which is, you know, one of the ways that militarism is institutionalized in our country is that, you know, as people have said, through the profit motive and the military-industrial complex.
Sandy, let me
and
stop you there for a moment.
So when anyone talks about cutting the military budget, there's all this pushback based on the notion that, oh, well, people are going to lose their jobs if we close these armaments factories. And the state of Connecticut recently, I don't know a whole lot about this, but they recently embraced an initiative around converting, accepting that there are going to be cuts in military spending, and at the state level, looking at how they can convert some of these industries, and so, you know, to avoid a loss of jobs, while at the same time accepting the cuts to the military spending. So that's another aspect of this. If people are not going to be building weapons, they need to be building something else. And of course, the Green Party has a great platform on the Green New Deal, which would not only counter militarism, but it will actually put people back to work on building alternative energy. A friend of mine who ran for Congress in Long Beach, California, Marcy Winograd, she got the endorsement of the Machinists Union in a plant building guided missiles, and they explicitly endorsed her, saying that they would rather be building turbines for windmills than parts for guided missiles. And so this is just another aspect of this. You know, that, I mean, we need to be pushing to demilitarize, to disarm, to cut these weapons programs and cut the military budget. But along with this, on the positive side, is all the other things that our country can do with those resources. And it has been demonstrated and proved by many, many studies that, in fact, military spending creates fewer jobs than almost anything else that we choose to do with that money. But there are questions around the transition that need to be addressed.
Absolutely. Hillary, let me ask you a question, dear. How many wars have you protested since you've been an activist?
Oh, let's see. Well, it depends on what level of protest, you know, you want to say. I mean, I was 12, 13 during the Vietnam War. So, but, you know, I was very aware of it and would have loved to be out in the streets, but, you know, my parents didn't think that was such a good idea. But I definitely went out during the first Iraq War, and then obviously second Iraq War and Afghanistan. So I'm a relative newcomer to this, I think I may have made up for in quantity.
There you go. There you
the
go.
The number of times out in the streets.
Well, you know, there's this marvelous book by Gore Vidal called Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace that lists all the wars we've had since the 40s. And
there's a lot that we don't even pay attention to.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
and not to mention the wars that are not big enough to be real wars. They're just little.
Exactly.
Little police actions. But we're going to talk about some of that issues in a minute. Let me go ahead and run this little spot. We have a sponsor, and it's the good people at Legal Shield. So let me play this for you.
What is Legal Shield? It's total access. It's total freedom. Everyone deserves legal protection. And now, with Legal Shield, everyone can access it. No matter how traumatic, no matter how trivial, whatever your situation is, we are there to help. From real estate to divorce advice, identity theft, and beyond. Legal Shield has your rights covered. With Legal Shield, you'll be able to talk to a dedicated, experienced attorney about whatever you want, as often as you want, for less than $20 a month, no matter what happens. Legal Shield will have you protected and empowered to worry less and live more. Please visit www.mrsdd.com. That's www.mrsdd.com. Legal Shield.
Legal Shield, an important service that all of us will need at some point in our lives. Welcome back to our peace show. Our next guest is Emini Dilek. Emini is an activist in international women's rights, publisher of Progressive Press, which deals with issues of education, health care, child care, and related social services for all citizens. A red rose is a symbol of democracy. Emini, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Emini, why don't you give us your perspective on tonight's show?
Okay, I think the Turkish-American, the first thing I want to mention what's happening in Turkey right now, and I think it's appropriate with the you know, the theme of the program, what the government is doing over there to its own people. And one of the, I think Hillary said about, oh, he should talk about bullying. I wanted to say that we have an expression in Turkish, I think it's in English too. It says, the fish smells from his head. When we look at our government, when our country bullies other countries, when our government, our justice system, our police bully its own citizens, and when the boss bullies its employees, and when the parents bully their kids, the kid is going to bully somebody. You know, it's, I believe it's a vicious cycle, and it starts from the top. I understand we need to educate the kids too. It's very important, but it's a whole society. It's a worldwide issue, actually. So once the other guests were talking about military spending, all that is curbed and changed, and we understand that, you know, 55% of our economy shouldn't be depending on our war spending, then, you know, we'll probably be a more peaceful nation and more peaceful world. And if you have any questions about what's going on in Turkey, I can talk about that too.
Well, let me ask you this, Emini. You know, we spoke. You speak about this culture of violence, the culture of bullying, how it's so pervasive in our society. One of the other things that is part and parcel with this is this glorification of war.
Yes.
You know, we could look at two recent examples and how the real tragedy of war was the press, and it was all draped in patriotism and honor and glory. And
correct.
Don't you think that is a big factor in people's acquiescence?
Huge. Well, as someone that's in media, even though we are very independent, you know, we actually fund our website ourselves out of our own pocket. You know, we don't take any advertisement right now. The media play a huge role, of course. I mean, the American people are shielded from the realities of war. What's happening? I mean, we're just learning after 10 years of, you know, Iraq war that the Afghanistan president was being sent the planes full of cash from our, you know, Treasury Department or from wherever, CIA, were giving him money, and we are here. And the total cost is going to be about $6 trillion now, all the research says. I think, I don't know who did the research, but it was from Reuters or one of those large media corporations explaining it. I believe, here we are in our nation, inside our domestic politics. We're fighting with each other, which to cut, which education schools are closing. We have 50 schools closing in Chicago because we don't have money. We didn't have money for shelters in Oklahoma when the the storm hit them. The school didn't have shelters, and the kids died there because it was too expensive. We didn't have money to build shelters for our schools. But meanwhile, we spent $6 trillion in wars. And when was media going to mention that? I mean, after the kids die? After the kids die, now we're talking about the shelters? Media, I mean... mainstream media, corporate media actually, is owned by 5-6 corporations right now, and that's a shame. That's a crying shame. I mean, Americans are not being informed. They're not understanding what's going on. That's why they get shocked when we talk about terrorism, when we talk about, you know, oh, why do, you know, people hate Americans? We help these people. They really don't know, a lot of people in the United States, what our government is doing on behalf of our, under our name in other countries. And the money spent on it, I mean, the cost, of course, we need to talk about the, you know, human cost, everything else, but the trillions of dollars when we're cutting meals for elderly in our country, we're cutting meals, school meals for poor kids, school lunches, and we can afford $6 trillion on wars, whose pockets are being filled up? Whose pockets are being filled up? I am learning now that Halliburton, for example, Dick Cheney was involved with that corporation. Halliburton, that got all the bids, they made over $39 billion for the rebuilding of Iraq. And meanwhile, our bridges falling over here, and people, our citizens are dying, and we don't have money for our infrastructure. So we need to get our priorities straight and soon, and media has to do its job. I mean, media has to do its job to inform and just do this hard-hitting news coverage, investigative coverage to bring information to American citizens, because really the Americans are kept in dark, and it's the media's fault.
Emily, let me ask you one question, if I may. Why don't you go ahead and briefly sketch out what's going on in Turkey and how this impacts the neighborhood of Turkey, Syria, etc.
Sure. Well, the Turkey is almost, it's very meaningful about what we're talking right now, actually. It's the same situation. It's about the government bullying its own people. It's the same thing. It's this violence, police violence on peaceful protesters. The people, originally it started from this little tiny little park, but it had a lot of historical importance for the people of Istanbul. There's a big square, it's called Taksim Square, and this was the only green area left in the area. It's called Gezi Park. And they decided, what they did, without even asking the locals, without even getting the approval of the people, they decided to just sell the place, the public place, to a private person, private companies, to build a shopping center. I mean, Istanbul already has like 90 shopping centers, so people just said, we just don't want that. We don't want our park to be demolished. We don't want our trees that has been here for years to be cut. So they started this really small-scale, peaceful sit-in protest against the demolition of the park. And then the police decided to just violently attack on them. And they've been sending all these tear gases, pepper spray, and then the water cannons. And then, of course, the reaction got bigger because more people got upset about it, and they're saying there was only 500 people there. Now people just, I think the situation is kind of like the last straw broke the camel's back, to be honest with you, because this kind of was brewing up. There was a lot of resentment towards the Erdogan's government lately, because this third term he's elected, you know, democratically elected. He's not a dictator, but he kind of took over and started trying to govern in a very authoritarian way, this term especially, and people kind of say, they're pushing back, they're saying that we just don't want it this way, we want more freedoms, and it's really turned into, from about being a small park and trees, it's turned into about being not heard, it's turned into about the abuse of the state power, it's turned into about media being censored. Turkish media is extremely censored, by the way. We have it bad here, but over there they have it worse. They don't have any independent media. And then the minority is not being protected. I mean, there was the gentleman, the Erdogan himself, was extremely anti-secular and Islamist person before, and then he kind of changed his ways, and I personally never trusted him, knowing him how he was before as a politician, being the hardline, really right wing, like extreme right wing before. I knew he didn't suddenly turn into this social democrat, but you know, he got elected, so it's the people's will, and everybody accepted it. It's in democracy. Unfortunately, he one of the first initiatives was infiltrate the judicial branch of Turkish government. You know, he basically switched the judges. He changed the judges, and he put the most hardliner Islamist in the judicial branch. And the next step towards his Islamic ideas was to penetrate the police. The police is basically, they're very Islamist. They're very anti-secular, you know, his party's followers. And then the third step was dismantling the top brass of the Turkish military. They're all in jail right now. And there are a lot of journalists, there are more journalists in jail in Turkey today than in any other country. Just not Iran, not China, that's in Turkey. So there is a lot going on, and it was, like I said, it was kind of like the last straw broke the camel's back, and people are pushing back. I'm hoping it'll calm down. He will manage to be a good leader once in his life and, you know, calm everything down instead of hurting more people more and being more violent towards them, you know, the police. So hopefully, we don't, of course, want military to get involved. So that's what's happening.
Emily, I'd like to follow up on Rick's question, and we only have about a minute or so left. But,
sure.
You know, given Turkey's proximity to Syria, how do your fellow countrymen view what's going on in Syria? Are they worried about it spilling over, or just what's the perspective on the war going on in Syria right now?
Sure. That was another problem between what the people of Turkey wanted and what the government wanted, which was different, because the government wants to get involved with Syria, and they want a regime change. They want Assad to be gone. And the Turkish people absolutely do not want a war with their next-door neighbor. Turkey has been out of war since the World War War, and, you know, we have been peaceful with our fellow neighbors around us, so there was no war other than just one intervention in Cyprus in 1974, but that wasn't a full-scale war. So they really don't want it. The people themselves, the Turkish people, they do not want a war, and they're, of course, very nervous and worried about it. Plus the over 300,000 right now, the refugees that moved from Syria, and they're very uncomfortable with that situation too, because there was a bombing last month on the border town Reyhanlı, where the refugee camps were, and it was a provocation, of course, from the Turkish people, say it's from the opposition forces that are trying to get the Turkey involved in the situation. And then they arrested a few people, but the view on the ground is basically Turkish people do not want the war with, and they prefer the peaceful way of solving the problem. Hopefully, more international negotiations and peace talks, and there will be some other meetings to more a political solution.
Well, thanks very much, Suki. Are you on?
I'm here.
Welcome, Suki DeYoung. Suki, tell us a little about your perspective on the work of peace right now.
Okay. Thanks, Richard, and thanks everyone on this panel, everyone out there listening. Thanks so much for having me on the show. So I'm active with a few groups. Everglades Earth First is the one I'm most active with, and we're an environmental group. I'm also active with Code Pink. I'm Green Party. I'm registered Green, a little active in Florida Green stuff. I'm on the executive committee of the Loxahatchee Sierra Club, and I'm a little bit active with Move to Amend. So when I asked an anarchist friend of mine for ideas on what to say about this topic, where do peace activists go from here, he said, how about not being a peace activist? And I think he's coming from an anarchist perspective, and I think what he was getting at was so-called armchair activists, that the peace activist of the future needs to get into the streets. It really has gotten that serious. And I think we're seeing that in Turkey right now. Another uprising of the people, as the our previous well-versed in what's going on in Turkey speaker was talking about, it started in a park in the middle of Istanbul. Folks are trying to stop a park from being bulldozed for yet another mall, and trying to save some green space for their beautiful city. And it escalated from there because the police acted so egregiously violent.
Correct.
Yeah, and so I think where peace is going from here is that the era of being led by a regime or a government, if you will, is basically over. You know, we need a new roadmap. We need a new template. And this is not a plan by a group of people. It's an overall energy shift, as Gwendolyn was saying. There is definitely a new paradigm in the universe and the planet happening. And we humans are realizing that we're actually very awesome. We are really awesome. But because of the creative suppression caused through most of the world having to work under lousy, boring, and often dangerous conditions, as we recently saw in Bangladesh, and they have to do this, you know, this everyday work in order to live, in order to eat, that potential is not being realized. And that potential is everything. It's absolutely everything. It's all we have to offer. It's the most precious thing we have to offer, and it's the most valuable thing we have to offer. And it's also the most important thing we have right now. It's our planet. It's everyone's planet. So everyone living on the planet Earth needs to have their energy be in the mix. And that's why the people in Turkey got so angry about being suppressed so violently that they walked into town when the regime shut down the metro over a student environmental protest. You know, it probably would have ended right there if the bulldozers had been stopped. But because of police... Hello?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, but because the police reacted so violently to them, the people are saying, hey, screw you, and by the way, we don't like your recent repressive laws either, and they're fighting back.
Correct.
And I think that more creative actions and a lot of energy by a lot of people getting together is what's needed. You know, I recently returned from the GE Tree Summit. That's genetically engineered trees in Asheville, North Carolina. And they had their summit up there this year. It's usually out of the country, but it was in Asheville, North Carolina this year. And the folks in Asheville and from all over, especially the Global Justice Ecology Project, were there and had done a lot of organizing. And I'm going to talk a little bit about another way, you know, to create peace. So at this organization of protesting this GE summit, GE Tree Summit, there was art, there was original songs, and explaining through the bullhorn exactly what we were opposing, why we were opposing the conference. So as we were standing outside the hotel while the presentations were being made inside about why GE trees are going to save the world, by basically burning them for biomass fuel for export to Europe, we were out there explaining through the bullhorn the scientific reasons why we oppose genetically modifying the trees that give us oxygen, that give us the rain, that give us shade, that give us life. And the conference goers listened, and we changed the conversation inside. So we interrupted their rhetoric by taking direct action. Not by emailing, not by writing, not by making a film. We marched to the conference on our own 2 feet. I drove up there. It took me 12 hours to get up there. There's about 100 of us got together, and some were carrying beautifully painted leaves on poles with long tassels. Some were in hazmat suits carrying the dead trees. And when we got to the conference, we started singing, chanting, and yelling. and they listened, and we changed the conversation. And changing the conversation is very powerful today, and I'll tell you why. And this is the last thing I'd like to address, which everyone has already addressed, and it's the media. And it is, it's all about the conversation. If the mainstream media can keep us distracted with how Michael Douglas got cancer through oral sex, I mean, that's hard not to read, isn't it? But that's so sensationalist. And why are all the major news sources on the Internet today and on TV running that as a headline when there's a huge uprising in Turkey, when Monsanto scientists are trying to change the DNA of our trees because we supposedly need more dirty energy? The drone attacks sanctioned by President Obama are killing innocent civilians, and Gitmo is still open. Well, I'll tell you why, because if they can keep the conversation going about trivial, sensationalist, sexist, racist, homophobic topics that are designed to divide us, then they're hoping we won't have the time to work together for the things that really matter to humankind and to all living things. If we can change the conversation on a global scale, we can get the information out to people by any means possible, and I believe that's what's happening now. Everything is being exposed. It's not possible anymore in this new age of transparency to keep these kind of secrets. All the dark, hidden agendas of the Vatican are coming out. The hidden agenda of Monsanto is being exposed. If we can work to get journalists to report the real news, this is going to be key to achieving working peace in the future. And, yeah, I guess that's about it for me.
Thank you, Suki. Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. So our next guest is Anita Stewart. Anita,
I'm here.
Okay, Anita, just welcome to have you. Let me just tell our folks a little bit about you. Anita is our co-chair of the Green Party of Florida and interim president of the new chapter of Veterans for Peace in Tampa, past co-creator and organizer of Chapter 119, Veterans for Peace in St. Petersburg and Code Pink in Tampa. Anita, you come with us with a very impressive array of credentials. Tell us your thoughts this evening.
I'm kind of torn by what so many have already said here, and we've got quite a different array of activists and peace people, and I'm so glad you all asked me to be part of this collective intelligence, which is amazing. Because when we all put our brains together and our thoughts and our energies together, we can come up with some amazing ideas about how to move forward. My thoughts, I think, began when I first... Now, if I lose you all, can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you fine.
Okay, because it is getting ready to storm here, so just in case you lose me, it's because I've had a power outage. But in any case, I think I started to learn the term pro-peace when I was working for the Kucinich campaign, but before that I had definitely seen how the media underplayed things when I was living in Washington, D.C., and the Gulf War I started. Of course, as you all know, if anybody here had been watching the media at that time, Gulf War I began with a bang and was pretty much over just as
well.
Watch your microphone noise. If you're not speaking, please mute your mic.
But in any case, it was amazing because there were huge protests going on the Mall in D.C., but yet, and usually the Washington Post would always report how many people were on the Mall protesting, but it was like we knew they were there because we were going into D.C. every day to work or run errands or whatever, so we knew the protesters were there in full force, but there was no reporting on them, and I thought, that is just amazing that they can just minus out thousands of people that are expressing their voices about this particular issue. And, you know, it was just an amazing thing to see. And I thought, this is the propaganda. I started to see the media for what it really was at that time. And after having grown up in a radio station that my father owned, it was just amazing to see how it could be all manipulated. So I started to understand more about corporate-driven media, but also the pro-peace term, which really I heard from the Kucinich camp back in 2006 when I started working for his presidential campaign. At that point in time, I think we were gearing up for all these different elections, and the peace movement had really been resurrected in 2002, 2003, 4, and 5. But it was starting to dwindle down a little bit at that point, and we as pro-peace activists were trying to get leaders elected that would carry through ending the wars and bringing the troops home. And that was a real strong message from Veterans for Peace and from Code Pink at that time. Well, as you all know, what's happened since, of course, is trying to, the American people elected Obama as their peace, pro-peace candidate. And I don't want to get into the political end of this, but everything that he said he was going to do, he has not done. And instead of us focusing, as Suki said, on the things, the matters at hand, we've become more fractured with these different groups and different missions and different endeavors. And I think most of these have been a distraction, at least for me. So in the past year or two, I've been listening to people like Michael Ruppert, Cindy Sheehan, people that are talking about localism and bringing it all back into our community. So as Suki said, it's great to get out there and reframe the message and to change the topic of the conversation. I've been trying to find ways to get local, grow my garden, network with others that are doing the same, and reading more along those lines of localism. There's two books that I suggest people to read. One is called The Next American Revolution by a 97-year-old lifelong activist, Grace Lee Boggs. And this book is just amazing. You can get it on your Kindle. It's better to get it on hardcover. And she says the most revolutionary act that you can do in this particular time frame is to grow food. And we know the food issue is a big thing, as we experienced with the March Against Monsanto events, which were global this past weekend. Janice Ray, an activist, educator, seed saver, wrote another book about how our seeds are actually disappearing, and 90% of the seeds for our food are gone, and the rest are pretty much owned by Monsanto, and the other two groups two companies, DuPont and Synergia, I think, are the other two that own the rights to most of our seeds. But the book is called The Seed Underground, The Growing Revolution to Save Food. And I suggest those for anybody that's homesteading, that's trying to bring it all local, and to growing a garden is a peaceful act. You can't help but be peaceful in the garden. And growing food is what we're all going to be needing to do, because as soon as these wars for oil escalate and oil and gas and petrol become way out of reach for us to buy, we're going to need to be keeping it local. The other movements that I think are really, really important, and they've really made activists of many people that have never thought of doing activism before or protesting for peace or the environment, was the Gulf oil disaster, of course. Everybody has to have clean soil, clean water, fresh air, food, clothing, shelter. We have to have those things to survive. And it's so, so important for us to be front and center about what's happening with these things. We can incorporate environmental with peace, but I really think it's much better when we do that. And what the other point is, what is the legacy that we leave behind for the next seven generations, as the First Nations would say? I think that's really important, too. We have to see that.
Yeah.
Oh, peace, environment, and growing food and movement, like transition, which is developing communities that are transiting, making the transition off the dependence of fossil fuels. Those are the things we need to concern ourselves with, because our leaders are not going to do it for us. I just want to make these final points. Our leaders are not going to do it. They are bought. We can beg them. We can sign petitions from here until the cows come home. I think most, personally, I think most of the petitions are probably shit canned before they're even reviewed. I would say we have to become our neighborhood. We have to become our leaders with our local people. We have to mobilize and organize and make sure that we're going to have the things that we need to survive, not just 10 years from now, but maybe even 3 months from now. And I encourage people to join transition movements in whatever towns you're in. If there isn't one, an active one, then create one. I think this is really, really important. Veterans for Peace is another organization I'll keep working with. And actually, with the Green Party of Florida and my radio show, I really don't have much room or time to do much else. But the Green Party
It sounds like you're doing a lot of great stuff already, Anita. I mean, these are all very important issues.
I want to just one more point. ShadowCabinet.us. It was created because in a lot of other countries, a shadow cabinet is formed by the losing party or groups to show what kind of government we can have. So I encourage people to go to the greenshadowcabinet.us and look at those esteemed educators and leaders and marvelous people that we could have, and make them our leaders. Ask them questions. Send them emails. That's all I have to say.
Thanks so much, Anita. Mr. Mankey has gotten cut off, so we'll hope that he comes back in. Oh, you're here. Oh, wonderful. I'm sorry. Mr. Mankey, please tell us a little about yourself and what your perspective is on peace, the peace movement today.
Sure. I'm involved. My main involvement right now is working with casino workers in the Indian game industry who are trying to organize unions. But I've been involved in the peace movement for years, going back to the Vietnam War. I opposed the Vietnam War since I was about 12 years old. I was arrested for protesting and picketing and passing out leaflets during the Vietnam War. And I told Nixon to take his war and shove it. And I think that's what we should all do. But I think one of the problems we have in this country when we talk about peace is we really don't understand history as a people, and we don't understand the nature of imperialism. And a lot of people aren't willing to recognize that, our country was founded in a very violent manner, taking the land and the resources away from Native American people. Slavery added more violence. And, Mark Twain remarked that I wasn't an anti-imperialist until the Spanish-American War. And that was America's first imperialist war, was the Spanish-American War. And we're still, ironically, paying for that war. People don't understand this. But during the Spanish-American War, this country took the Philippines, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Guam. We still have troops in the Philippines today. We're paying millions and millions of dollars to suppress the movements of the people for freedom in the Philippines after 100 years. So imperialism comes with a very heavy cost. And unless we recognize that, this is all about imperialism when we talk about peace and wars, we're going to keep it's like a dog chasing its tail. We'll never understand what we're actually fighting for and the kind of peace that we want. Imperialism is the highest stage of capitalism, and it's become very barbaric, in my opinion, and I think lots of people agree. And when I use that word barbaric, I mean barbaric. You look at Obama and his drone wars. How much more barbaric can a society get than to launch these drone strikes against people? And he thinks nothing of killing, you know, 10, 20 people trying to target somebody that he has on his hit list sitting on his desk, and all the only people that get killed are children and their mothers and old people. You know, this is a disgrace. It's barbarism at its worst. And until we recognize the nature of these wars as being imperialist wars, we're in a sad shape in this country. Because, we're having these austerity measures shoved down our throats. I heard people before talk about, you know, cutting funding for school lunches. Now we had a whole group of some 28 United States senators who actually voted, Democrats who voted not to reinstate billions of dollars in cuts to food stamps, and yet these same senators vote time and time again for wars. I heard people talk about, you know, we need to petition, we need to write letters. I agree with that. I think we need to write a lot of letters to members of Congress. We need to petition Congress and Obama and the president. But, you know, I think that the last caller made the point that, you know, these petitions and letters are probably ending up in the trash cans. And unless we take those petitions and the letters and we sit down with our friends and neighbors and discuss why we're writing these letters, and to begin to discuss what we as a people have to do to get out into the streets to put an end to these wars, like we did during the Vietnam War, these wars are going to continue. We see that these people in Congress, they've all been bribed by the military-industrial complex, every single one of them. There isn't a single one that hasn't been bribed by the military-industrial complex. And to think that we can call them up and say, oh, we don't like your wars, and it's going to have an impact, I think is very naive in thinking that. But we got to keep doing it. But at the same time, the main focus has to be on organizing in our neighborhoods, where we work, where we go to school, and begin to get people together, not only to go to the streets, but why do we constantly have to keep influencing the politicians? Why don't we have politicians that reflect what the American people want, peace? This is what we got to start talking about doing. We need a new political party in this country. The Democrats are worthless when it comes to peace, when it comes to social needs. They're totally worthless. They're one part of the two-party trap. And unless we break free from this two-party trap, we're going to remain on the road of wars, war after war after war. That's all that this system has to offer the American people, because the military-industrial complex, these Wall Street parasites, they get rich off of these wars, and they're not going to stop these wars. When we talk about... is my time
I was up? Just going to say thank you, Alan. What I want to do now is I'm going to open up the round table, and what we're going to do is we're going to ask a series of questions and then ask each of you to react to the question and give us your thoughts as succinctly as you can so we can get through several questions. Okay, Alan?
Sure. Okay, can I say one more thing about...
Sure, go ahead. One more thing. Absolutely.
Okay. There's been talk about the environmental movement. I think what a lot of people don't realize is that the military-industrial complex has the largest carbon footprint of any industry in this country or in the world. And it takes literally millions and millions of gallons of fuel to keep this military machine going. That's it.
Thank you very much, sir. I'm going to give the first question to my good friend and co-host, Renee. Go ahead, Renee.
I have a question for each of the panelists. We are all of the generation that started out protesting the Vietnam War, even though we may have been too young to actively go out on the street. And fast forward 30 years, and we are the generation that controls still most of the levers of power in this country, politically, economically, and so forth. My question is, looking at your work in peace activism, is there a generational change that we can look to as hope in this issue in the future, Or will the current younger generation, up and coming, be as co-opted in the economic game as many of our generation have?
Let's go ahead and start with Sandy.
Well, I have quite a lot of hope for the next generation, based on looking at my own kids and their friends. And I think, you know, people always make the comparison with the Vietnam War, but, you know, in Vietnam there was a draft, and so young people were very directly affected. Their friends were either going off to fight or being thrown in jail or having to leave the country. And so I don't know, you had a kind of multi-part question there, and I don't quite remember all of it. But I do think that somehow people have been made in this country to feel that we have no power.
It is
a very large country, and that's why it's important for us to organize, to come together. Because, you know, when large groups of people come together and do things, then we do have power. You know, we've been divided by this philosophy of individualism, but if we can come together collectively, you know, through whatever organizations we each want to work with, then I think, you know, we actually have an awful lot more power than we realize.
Sandy, thank you. Let me pass it on to Jay. Jay Jansen, sir, your reaction to the younger generation versus ours. Jay, are you there? Okay, not hearing Jay. Let me pass it on to Gwen.
Hey, Rick. I'll keep it succinct.
I don't think that
the environmental decline that we're witnessing before us is going to sustain the economic it's not a reality, but the economic social climate as it is now. I think there's huge change going underway. I want to compliment all my co-panel here on all of their positions. There is change going on right now, and the kids that are coming up at this point right now are much different than we were, as we were much different than the generation before. And in this way, they also, kids are born with bigger brains. They're born with a lot more aptitudes, and they are the ones who are going to find people like us saying things that we are on the internet and in this new technology theater, if you will. So
thank you, Gwen. Hillary, let me ask you the same question, dear.
Okay.
The next generation versus our generation.
Gotcha. I think if you'd asked me this question in the early days of the Iraq War, I would have been a lot more concerned. We had something amazing happen here with our young people at FAU, at Florida Atlantic University, where the university decided, it wasn't necessarily a peace activist thing, but I suddenly saw the young people come into action and in such a creative way. When the administration had decided to take a $6 million gift from Geo Prison Corporation to name the school stadium the Geo Stadium. And let me tell you, what I saw in the student activists and their creativity and the way they started organizing, how were they going to bring into each of their classes to educate each of their classes on what was going on, was so inspiring. And the fact that Geo Group pulled out, and recently the president of the university stepped down, I think was the most powerful lesson that anyone could have gotten from a university situation. And that gave me a lot of hope. Granted,
Thank
it's
you.
Only on one local level, but it was very exciting.
Thank you, Hillary. Emily, your thoughts?
Sure. I have a lot of hope. I mean, not only in our nation, in the United States, from Occupy movement to U.S. Uncut and, you know, Idle No More, all these grassroots movements that have done very well and they're still active. I also think globally there are, you know, youth are connecting with each other. Just with what happened in Turkey, I mean, we got so many. We were inundated with Twitter messages, support videos, music videos supporting from Spain to Azerbaijan to it's everywhere. So I have a lot of hope, especially with the social media. So that's very important that we have to keep social media free and not get control under governments. It has to be people's media, and the social media, internet, is the people's media. And there's a wonderful way of connecting with each other. And everybody in Turkey, too, they the groups that connected with each other through Twitter, where there were makeshift hospitals for the people that got injured from the police, and the, you know, attorneys, they were helping them. They all connected together. So I have a lot of hope, not only for our nation. I think there's a major global shift that's happening globally, internationally. So I have a lot of hope.
Thank you so much. Suki.
Yeah, what everyone said is really great. And, you know, it's a really good question because I work with young, you know, people a lot younger than me, a lot, and they, you know, they do say to me, well, your generation got co-opted, you know. And I look at them and say, well, what makes you think yours isn't going to get co-opted? So it's a really good question, but I think that, you know, there is so much hope. Because, indeed, you know, there is an energy shift going on, and we're all going to get caught up in it. And it's not going to matter how old you are or what generation you're from, because evolution is working, and, you know, there's no stopping it. So, social media, the seeing what's going on at FAU and how successful they were, all those things, and really give me a lot of hope.
Thank you. Anita?
I'm kind of on both ends of the spectrum here. I have a lot of hope after seeing the amazing young people come together after this march against Monsanto. They are so together here in Tampa trying to get a ballot initiative started for the whole state in regards to having GMO foods labeled. And this happened like overnight. It's just amazing. But I have worked as a nanny for the first time for the past 9 months, a part-time nanny. And I've seen children that are ingrained in a culture of war because of what's around them, like just a simple Call of Duty game for their Xbox or whatever they're seeing on television. And that concerns me. And I still think that we have time to turn it around, but I think it's very, very important that we consider the children and what they're taking in and what's become normal for them to see in their games and in their movies and their TV shows.
Thank you so much. Okay, let me take this to Alan. Alan, your thoughts?
Oh, I definitely have a lot of hope for the next generation because, you know, we see all these young people in struggle right now. They're in struggle against global warming. They're in struggle for peace and social justice. They're in struggle against Monsanto. We have Idle No More. We have the Occupy movement. Every place you go, people are, young people especially, are in motion, and they're totally fed up with what's going on in this country. And it's because people are fed up and won't take what's being dished out to them, that is what gives me a lot of hope that we're going to see change.
Well, all of that is certainly very encouraging. I have a follow-up question to that. And we are probably the only industrialized country that doesn't have a draft. And as counterintuitive as that may seem, if we did have a draft, we'd have more skin in the game. Is this something worth contemplating?
Absolutely not. And no, that's wrong, actually. Most industrialized countries no longer have a draft. And, Yeah, that's just not the answer. You know, I understand the rationale for what you're saying, but I don't think that's the answer. I think we need to act, and one of the things that we were doing here in Miami during the Iraq War was counter-recruiting, going to high schools, using this excellent materials you can get from the American Friends Services Committee. There's a great flyer called Do You Know Enough to Enlist? And we were directly talking to kids who are thinking of joining the military and, you know, persuading them not to. And that's an avenue of peace activism that I don't see a lot of people doing right now, but I think that is very important. If I had a bit more time, that is something I would like to start doing again.
Thank you. Let me go ahead and take that down to Jay. Are you back? Jay Jansen, are you
here?
Yes. Hello, Jay.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes.
What's the question? Did you hear the question about the draft? Would the draft make a difference?
Just a minute. You know, all this conversation is going on while we're killing people in a dozen countries, and I don't hear anyone talking about that. I mean, there's no way in hell all this talk about Congress or writing letters and everything that's been going on for two centuries. Why would it change now? It's a question of business. There are laws. There are laws against killing, and you people should be implementing those laws. You should be calling for the prosecution of U.S. crimes against humanity in Syria right now, in Somalia, Yemen, in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and you're not, you know.
Well, Jay, excuse me. This is Sandy. I agree with everything you're saying. And that is what we are talking about. That is why we are all talking.
That's what I mean.
About
you're
doing
talking.
The things we're
you're
doing.
Talking, but you're talking, but you're not asking for the prosecution of your country.
Yes, I wrote a book about the Iraq War, calling for the prosecution of American war criminals, and I write about
that
all the time.
That's great. Well, what about today? I've been on the phone for 2 hours. I've heard everything about trees, about Syria, about
but because
Turkey.
We're talking about
nothing,
organizing,
nothing about
Jay.
Us
we're talking
nothing
about organizing
about,
people.
Nothing about
action.
Us chilling.
Jay, we're talking about the tactics.
I'm sorry, but go ahead. But please don't talk down all the other people on this call. We are all working for the same thing together. So can you say something?
Say something more that we can do.
Stop.
Let me say one sentence without being interrupted. What do you think my kids and my family and my students over in Vietnam, everybody in the orchestra lost people to killed by the Americans, they would say. What do you think they would think about this conversation? And what do you think
they would probably think that these people are interested in trying to make a difference.
A difference in what? It's clear what to do. You've got to bring your country under
Whoa. Wait a minute, Jay. Everyone sitting at this table makes a demonstrative contribution to the effort of peace. And there are human rights groups out there that are taking actions every day. And we work with them.
What lives have been saved so far?
Many lives have been saved.
No lives have been saved. I've been living out there, my dear.
Okay.
That's where I lived all my life.
Yeah. Listen, Jay, I was in Ushil in Guatemala a year ago, okay? I know people the same as you do who have been slaughtered. I was shown around a village in Ushil last year by a young lady whose grandfather had been decapitated, beheaded by a death squad. And, you know, we all, you know, many of us have traveled to those countries and know people in those countries, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You just seem to be trying to make some point that you're somehow unique and that, you know, you are not. You know, we are all human beings. We're all trying to work for peace here.
And I think the reason we wanted to bring a panel together, Jay, is so that we'd hear a lot of different perspectives. So while that's one tactic to solve this problem, there are many other tactics that make sense. Okay, let me pass this question on to Anita.
If you can't stop the killing, then forget it. You can't stop
this. Is called
Jay. Thanks, Jay.
This is called consciousness raising, isn't it?
No, stop the killing.
Yes, that's what we want to do, Jay. We agree with you.
We do agree with
we want to stop the killing.
Okay, Anita.
That's why we're all doing what we're doing.
It's against the law.
I don't think go ahead and repeat the question.
I
just
agree.
Want to make sure
Obama is a war criminal. We want to prosecute Obama, Bush, all of them. We agree.
What
now, what are you going to do about
anybody
it?
Anybody disagrees with that?
We're not the criminals? Only Obama?
All of them. The generals, the civilians, all of them. Yes, they should all be prosecuted.
Yeah,
we
and
understand.
You and me, too.
We agree.
You and me. You and me as well. We're American.
Okay, let's continue.
No, we need to pay reparations. There is individual responsibility and there is collective responsibility. We need to
We need to
pay reparations to Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, all these countries. You know, Nixon agreed to pay $3 billion to Vietnam. It still has not been paid. You know, that is collective responsibility. But more importantly, we need to stop these wars. We need to dismantle this war machine and disarm. And, you know, this is what we're talking about, and this is why we're all doing what we're doing.
Okay, let me start a new question. We may have time to get through. Excuse me, Jay. I'm going to cut you off now because you've not been doing nothing but interrupting. Thank you very much, Jay, for your contribution. Okay, then we'll leave you in. Okay, I do want to try to go through one more question. In fact, the question is focused this way. There's issues of war profiteering that have never been prosecuted. There's issues of war crimes. There's issues of payoffs and bribery. There's issues of military misconduct. How wide do we need to focus, or do we need to focus more tightly?
Hello?
Yeah, I think we got
the moderator.
Rick?
Hold on. Yes. Okay. We've had a range of problems, whether it be war profiteering or the use of uranium-tipped weapons. Reparations is an issue. War crimes trials are an issue. But the question is, they keep spreading war. We had 1 million people in the street to try to stop the Iraq war. What is it going to take to get their attention? And your thoughts. Let me start with Alan.
Well, you know, I think it's going to take a new political party, a working class based progressive people's party, fighting Wall Street for power, because you know, everything that you've described is part of imperialism, and unless we confront this problem, we're not going to be able to solve the problem, because we can't leave these people in power. We just can't. We have to take power out of the hands of Wall Street, which is profiting from war.
Thank you, Anita.
I believe in that completely, but I do also believe we already have that party that's always been at the forefront of these issues, including Wall Street, Move to Amend, stopping the war. I urge people to go to gp.org and check the platform out. It's not light reading, and it's very detailed, but we have the 10 key values of the Green Party of the United States and the platform to go over, and I'm convinced that anybody who looks over the platform and the 10 key values will know that that's what most Americans want.
Thanks very much.
So I challenge everybody to check that out. We have the party. We just need the people in it instead of many people being caught up in the two-party paradigm that hasn't done us any.
Let me pass it to Suki. Suki, go ahead.
Hi, we need to take them down. It's not working. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, it's not working. We can't work. We had to work outside of their system, because as long as we dance to their tune, we're doing exactly what they want us to do. And
thank you.
It is. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, Emily.
Yeah, I think the campaign finance reform is very important if we want decent politicians that works for people. We have to have a campaign finance reform where there is public financing for campaigns. Otherwise, the money is going to run this town again.
Thanks a lot. Hillary?
I'm hearing about, you know, third party. The problem is until we get something along the lines of instant runoff voting, we're going to keep doing what we've done with the third party, and it's going to – I would love to see that work, but I think we need to fight for something like instant runoff voting in order to get one of these third parties. In the meanwhile,
another laudable topic.
There are those – pardon?
Thank you. I said another laudable idea. It's a great tactic.
So in the meanwhile, there are those of us who have been working inside and outside of the Democratic Party and with the Progressive Caucus, which, you know, we're just trying to push it from the inside, but also do work from the outside, like with different organizations.
Thanks. Thanks, Hill. Let me talk to Gwen.
Rick, I think that humanity on this planet craves a new vision completely. None of the isms, ologies, ocracies have worked. They're all failing us right now. We crave a new vision, and until we get there, good folks like ourselves need to chop wood and carry water and keep it up. Just keep working.
Thanks so much. That was awesome, Gwen. Jay, go ahead, buddy. What is your thoughts on this stuff?
Well, a lot of people have said good things about being responsible. Now, I feel like I'm drenched in blood. At 82 years old, I felt this way most of my life. Now, I don't think most of the people here, unfortunately, feel that way. I think they feel something can be corrected in the government. That's not true.
Thanks, Jay. Let me give it to Sandy to wrap it up.
Well, I think, you know, we just live in a very, very strange country and a strange time right now, where, you know, superficially, you know, we're able to vote, and yet in November, 99% of people went out and voted for the status quo, for either Obama or Romney. And, you know, I think this is something, you know, we really have to grapple with and come to terms with. This is very similar to, you know, someone from East Germany explained that basically about a year before they started tearing down the Berlin Wall, they had an election and 98% of the people voted for Erich Honecker. And then a year later, they were tearing down the wall. So, you know, most of those people who voted for Romney and Obama, you know, live in states where they know perfectly well that their vote makes no difference. They know who's going to win a year before the election. If you live in New York, you live in California, you live in Alabama, Texas, and somehow people are still persuaded to vote for these candidates. And, you know, I don't know how you break through that, but I just come back to where I started on this call, which is basically to say that we do have power, but we need to use it. We need to use it every which way that we can find, but we definitely should not give up on the simple things of joining groups that are working for the things we believe in, responding to calls for hundreds and thousands of people to pick up the phone and call their member of Congress.
Right. Boys, which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Sorry about that.
Yeah, I think
with
we know
that,
which
ladies,
side
I want
we're
to thank
on.
You. Let me thank you all for your commitment to peace. We're all working in the ways we think best. Thank you for your commitment. Thank you. We know which side you're on. And I want to thank you for joining us tonight. We appreciate your thoughts. And the goddess bless each and every one of you. Thanks for your work. Keep up the good
Thanks,
work.
Richard.
And we'll see you next week.
Thank you, Rick.
Okay.
Thanks for having us.
Good night,
Rick. Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Bye, everybody.
Peace out.
He'll be with you, fellow worker. side are you on?
Lousy scab, or will you be a man?